What's the difference between who, whose, and whom? That's what you'll learn in this episode of
Aprender Inglés con Reza y Craig.
Hello, 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 and welcome, welcome to everybody. My name's Craig.
My name's Reza.
And with over 45 years of teaching between us, we're going to help you improve your English and take it to the next level. Hi, Reza.
How are things, Craig?
Pretty good, my friend. How are you?
Oh, I'm really good. I'm on top of the world. I'm fit as a fiddle.
What does that mean, on top of the world and fit as a fiddle?
I'm on top of the world means I have things are going well, I'm happy. I'm as fit as a fiddle means I'm healthy, I'm well, no health problems. Great.
You're in good shape.
I'm in good shape. What about you?
I'm pleased to hear it. Yep, I'm good. I'm fine. And I'm really excited this week to talk about who and who's and whom, etc. But
who?
Who?
What?
Before, why? When? Before all that, let's listen to some feedback we received from Janet Hernandez from Mexico. Here's Janet's audio message.
Hello, guys. My name is Janet, and I'm from Mexico City. I listen to your podcast when I go to work because it's the best way to improve my listening skill while I stuck on the traffic. I find them very interesting and useful. You are so funny, and I love your accent. Thanks in advance for sharing your knowledge with everyone. Kisses from Mexico. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Janet.
And I love your accent too. I think you have a lovely accent when you speak English. And I'm very pleased that you're listening to us on your way to work. That's a very useful way of improving your English. You're probably listening in different ways, maybe from your computer. So maybe you're sitting at a desk or maybe you're doing exercise. But however you're listening, I think this podcast is a wonderful way to multitask, as Janet is doing, and listen and improve your English while you're doing something else, like driving to work, for example. So thanks very much for your message, Janet from Mexico.
And if there are other listeners from Mexico, and we think we do have quite a lot, we get quite a lot of feedback from Mexico. I can't think of a better place in the world to listen to our podcast going to work, because I've heard that it's such a big city that driving from one end of Mexico can take from one end to the other, can take about 3 or 4 hours. Yeah. You could listen to about 4 podcasts on the way. And don't get bored in the traffic.
Lots of traffic. Yeah, lots of opportunity to improve your English while you're stuck in traffic.
Listen to us. Forget about the traffic.
And we do get a lot of feedback from Mexico. Our next message actually comes from Anna from Mexico. So thank you to all of you listening in Mexico and for being so active and sending us your audio messages. We love hearing from you and hearing your voices. Let's listen to Anna and see what she says.
Hello, Reza. Hello, Craig. This is Anna from Mexico, and I would like you to talk about different uses of who. Who, whose, whom, from whom, and others. Congratulations for your great podcast. See you.
Who was that, Craig?
Who was that? That was Anna from Mexico. And thank you so much for your idea for today's podcast, Anna.
So, Anna, your wish is our command, we say in English. That means if you want something, we do it. You want to talk about who, whose, whom, and whose? Okay, let's do it. Let's go for it, Craig.
Yeah, there were two that sounded similar there. You may have noticed whose and whose sound exactly the same. But there is a difference, isn't there, Reza? The whos and whos are not written in the same way.
Yeah, but we'll get on to that. Let's spin this out a bit. Let's make the listeners wait until we reveal that.
Okay, I'm jumping ahead. I'm jumping the gun. I'm going too fast.
If you keep listening to us, you will understand the difference between whos and whose. Trust us. Just keep listening. So Let's get down to business. Okay, what is the difference? Well, first of all, to understand how to use those words, you first have to understand the difference between a subject, an object, and a possessive. Because we're going to be talking about that to explain the different uses of those words.
So subject, sujeto, object, complemento, and possessive, posesivo.
So you probably know this, but let's just make sure you do. The subject, in a sentence, does the action. Craig, can you give us a couple of examples with subjects?
Well, for example, if I say she works in a cafe, so she is the subject of the sentence. Or he likes cooking. Obviously, he is the subject and like is the verb. Or they bought a new car. Again, they, the subject, the people who bought the car.
The ones who are doing the action, right?
Exactly.
So then the opposite of the subject is the object. The object, let's say, receives the action. So let's focus on the object in these sentences. Everyone likes him. The word him. Him is the object because him receives the like. I don't know her. Her is the object. They didn't speak to us. To us. Us is the object. So the opposite of the thing that does the action, the subject, the opposite that receives it is the object, complemento.
Mm-hmm. And the possessive tells us the person that something belongs to. So, for example, his new mobile phone is really expensive. His new mobile phone. So the phone belongs to him. It's his mobile phone. Or another example, I like his sunglasses, not hers. So the words his and hers are the possessives. Or we're selling our flat. Our, nuestro. So that is the possessive, our flat. And the word who can be a subject pronoun. This in the same way as he, she, and they. Or who can be an object pronoun, like him, her, and us, that we've just explained. So we can use the word who, W-H-O, to ask which person did an action or which person is in a certain state, un estado específico. For example, with the subject question, who wrote the email? How would you say that in Spanish? Who wrote the email?
¿Quién escribió el email?
Mm-hmm. Another example, who is that girl over there? ¿Quién es esta chica ahí? Or who is getting the drinks? ¿Quién está comprando las bebidas? Who is getting the drinks? So that's asking about the subject. So Reza, what about the object? What about when we use who to speak about the person receiving the action? Can you give us some examples of that?
Sure. What about this? Who are you going to invite to the wedding? Who here is the object because you is the subject. You are going to invite people to the wedding. You is the subject. Who are you going to invite? Who is the object?
Mm-hmm.
Who did you meet last night is another example. Who again is the object because you is the subject. You met a person last night and I'm asking who you.
So if I answer that, I met Sarah, then I am the subject. So when I'm asked the question, I'm still the subject. Who did you meet last night? I met Sarah.
Another one, who has she chosen to go with? So she has chosen, she's the subject. Who is the object? Who has she chosen to go with? The answer might be she has chosen to go with Bob. Bob, that's who. So who is the object?
Remember, if you're following this, if you're following our explanations and you want to see it in writing, see it written, you can go to inglespodcast.com/154 and there you will find the show notes to everything we're speaking about. Now, moving on to the word whom, which is sometimes confused with who. So who, W-H-O, and whom with an M. W-H-O-M. It's not used very often, is it, Reza, these days? You don't hear the word whom, except maybe in formal English.
Yes. Most days you won't hear it spoken, most days of your life, as a native speaker even. Mm-hmm. Whom is always an object pronoun. It cannot be the subject. It's always the object. So it replaces words like him or her and us. And as Craig said, it's only used in formal English.
Yeah. Although most native speakers use who instead. I use who. I never use the word whom. Never.
But we'll give you a couple of examples. Whom are you going to invite to the wedding? Well, if you is the subject because you is the person doing the action, then whom is the object? So we can, if we want, add an M to who and say whom. But we don't have to. We can just say who if we want. We can say who are you going to invite to the wedding, or add M and say whom are you going to invite to the wedding. By adding the M, we're being more formal.
It sounds very strange to me. It sounds very formal, but it is correct. You can say it. Another example, whom did you meet last night? Again, you, the subject, so I met Sarah. Whom did you meet last night? Or, as most people say, who did you meet last night?
Or whom are they going to choose to manage Arsenal? Any idea, Craig? Are they going to change the Arsenal manager? Because you're an Arsenal fan, aren't you?
Well, I used to be, but my dad now is more of a hardcore, más fuerte, is more of a hardcore Arsenal fan than I am. And he said yesterday that apparently he's going to sign a contract for another 2 years, Arsene Wenger. Yeah. So I don't think they're going to replace him for the time being, for the moment.
In all those examples, we said you could say who or whom. Whom, if you want to be more formal. However, sometimes you must say the M in whom. Whom must go after a preposition, for example, not who. And it's always formal. Let me give you an example. The lady, very formal. The lady with whom Reza was dancing was the Marquise. That's Marquesa in Spanish. Oh, so this is a very formal situation. Imagine we're at a royal ball, a waltz or something, and someone said to me, someone said to Craig, who's that lady? And Craig said, oh, well, the lady with whom Reza was dancing was the Marquise. So he's being very formal. The lady with whom. With is a preposition. So after the preposition, we're obliged with whom to put the M. We cannot say with who. We must put the M in that situation, but it's very formal.
I've just had the picture in my head of you, Reza, dancing with a Marquise in a formal ball with a Strauss waltz or something in the background, waltzing around the floor. No, it doesn't work. Are there any more examples for when whom is preceded by a preposition, when the preposition becomes before whom?
Well, something which will be a lot more familiar perhaps to many of our listeners.
Than you dancing the waltz.
Dancing the waltz with the lady, Marquise. For whom the bells toll. I wouldn't be surprised if you've heard that before, because it's the title of a famous novel. For Whom the Bells Toll is Hemingway's famous novel set in the Spanish Civil War. Mm-hmm. For whom the bells toll. That's T-O-L-L. Toll is when a bell rings, but very soft and low to signify death, not for celebration, but for sad things. So for whom, because we have the preposition for first, we're obliged afterwards to say whom. We cannot say for who. We must add M, whom.
And it's a very poetic and formal title. Maybe in more common colloquial English, you would just say, who are the bells ringing for?
Right.
Which would be equally correct, but a lot more informal.
Craig, there's a typical thing which is actually written quite often, but only formally, at the top of a reference. What is that expression?
Yes, it's quite common to see the expression, to whom it may concern. To whom it may concern, which is a bit like saying dear sir or madam, because there's no sex, there's no gender in that. And it's a very formal way of addressing a letter, of starting an email or a formal letter when you don't know the person you're writing to. And as Reza said, or at the top of a reference, because anyone could potentially read it. You don't know who's going to read it. So to whom it may concern is a way of beginning a formal document, a reference, or a letter or email. And whom is also common in legal contracts as well. You often see the word whom written in legalese, in legal English.
All of these examples we've given so far of preposition with whom, they're all formal. But when the pronoun and preposition are separated, and or the pronoun comes first, then who must be used, not whom. So it's the reverse. Let's give you an example, and you'll see what I'm talking about. The woman who Reza was dancing with must have been a bit tipsy. Un poquito bebida.
Is that the Marquise?
Yeah. Well, you see, now this time it's not the Marquise. I've gone down in formality. My original sentence earlier was, the lady with whom Reza was dancing was the Marquise. Oh, that's very formal. But now, on a different occasion, in a less formal setting,
and now you're in a bar in Dublin.
I'm in a bar in Dublin, and everyone's drunk at least 10 pints of Guinness. So then we say, the woman who Reza was dancing with. I'll not translate that. La mujer, otro tipo de mujer. The woman who Reza was dancing with must have been a bit tipsy.
What does the tipsy mean? Tipsy.
I'll say it again. Un poquito bebida. I've already said it.
Oh, sorry.
I'll say it again.
I wasn't listening.
The woman who Reza was dancing with must have been a bit tipsy. So here I'm dividing the preposition with and who. So they're not together. Who comes first? The woman who, then the rest of the clause, Reza was dancing. And then at the end of the clause, with. Who Reza was dancing with. If I wanted to be more formal, I would say with whom Reza was dancing. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to be formal. So here I separate and I put who first and I put the preposition with at the end. Who Reza was dancing with. Here's another example. Who did they sell their old car to yesterday?
In Spanish, you'd start that by a quién.
Right. In Spanish, you always have to have them together.
Kind of like to whom, isn't it? A quién.
Exactly, yeah. This is the informal version. Mm-hmm. So we could say, to whom did they sell their old car yesterday? If we wanted to be formal. But in everyday English, you're more likely to hear, who did they sell their old car to yesterday? And the weird thing is, perhaps for you listeners, it's informal English, which is more difficult to get right.
And it is quite a complicated sentence because you've got the prepositions separate from sell, because sell something to, you've got to know that to is a preposition with sell. Who did they, past with did, who did they sell their car to yesterday?
Yeah,
quite a complicated construction.
It's much easier if you're a Spanish speaker to do it the formal way. It's much easier for you to say, to whom did they sell their old car yesterday? Because it follows Spanish, a quien, to whom.
It's easier, but you'd sound a bit strange.
You'd sound
a bit too formal.
Right, so you have to, if you want to be authentic and speak like a native speaker informally, you have to learn it this way. Who did they sell their old car to? But it's tricky. It's not easy. Imagine a conversation between a young boy and a mother. Craig, I'll be the mother. Can you be the young boy?
Mummy, can I go to the cinema tonight, Mum?
Who with? Like all mothers, I'm suspicious. I might let little Craig go or I might not. It depends who he's going with.
Oh,
so I ask him, who with?
Please.
So I'll think about it. I put the pronoun who first and then the preposition second, who with. I cannot say whom because who goes first and preposition second, who with. If I wanted to be very, very, very formal, I could say with whom, but that would not be typical for a mother to say to their child. You wouldn't be so formal, but in theory, the possibility exists.
And also notice the fact that you've got the question word who with a preposition. That's also very common. I sold my car yesterday. Next question, who to? So you just have the question word and the preposition. I'm going out tomorrow. Who with?
Shall we practice a few? Let's practice a few.
Okay.
Craig is going to read you. Craig is going to say something. Craig is going to say a statement, and we're going to pause for a little bit, and you have to answer him with a question, with who and a preposition, and then we'll tell you the right answer. But we'll leave a little pause to see if you get it right.
Ready? Number one, I bought a present yesterday.
Who for?
I've just read a really interesting book.
Who by?
I had a bad argument this morning.
Who with?
I've just read a really interesting biography on the internet.
Who about? So can you see there that we said who first and then a preposition? If we wanted to put the preposition first, it would be very formal and we would be obliged to say whom, about whom, with whom, to whom. But we warn you that you will hear native speakers getting this wrong. You do sometimes hear people say with who, but that is wrong. If you write that in a first certificate exam, you get it wrong. You have to say with whom if you do it in that order. Otherwise, you do the opposite order, who with. That is a rule.
Moving on to the word whose, which is spelled W-H-O-S-E. Now, this is a possessive adjective, like her or our. It can also be a possessive pronoun like hers or ours. In Spanish, it means de quién or de quiénes because it can also be plural. And we use whose to find out which person something belongs to. For example, whose glass is this? De quién es este vaso? Or whose is this jacket? Or whose jacket is this?
Ah, there are two possible word orders.
Yeah, you can change the word order. Whose is this jacket? And whose jacket is this? Or you see a book on a chair and you say, I see this book on my chair. Whose is it? De quién es? Whose is it? Whose are these when it's plural? But it can be confusing, can't it, Reza? Because there's the W-H-O-S-C, de quién or de quién es, and then there's the W-H-O-apostrophe-S with exactly the same pronunciation, whose, and W-H-O-apostrophe-S is the contraction of who is, and they're pronounced exactly the same. Can you think of any examples with the second one, W-H-O-apostrophe-S, whose?
Yeah, it's very common in everyday English. For example, we hear the doorbell ding, ding. And we say, oh, who's that ringing the doorbell? Who is, whose? That's W-H-O apostrophe S. Or that's the person who's coming with me to Brian's party. That's the person who is, who's coming with me to Brian's party. So even though it sounds the same as de quién o de quién es, you will know from the context which one it is, hopefully.
And one thing about the pronunciation, there's an S in both words, W-H-O-S-E or W-H-O apostrophe S, but it's not a S-S sound. The sound is with vibration, vibración, in the throat, in a garganta. So you can feel your vocal cords vibrating like a Z. Whose? Whose? Whose is it? Whose is it? So if you put your hand on your throat, try to feel that vibration when you're pronouncing the Z in whose. So I hope that's clarified the differences between who, whom, whose, etc. Remember, you can find all the information of the examples we've given on the webpage in the show notes at inglespodcast.com/154.
Well, if you're looking for an English teacher, but you don't know who to choose, iTalki might interest you. iTalki is an online service where you can choose who you want to teach you. You can have a look at the teachers available for English or any language you want. You can look at their profile. You can look at their experience, their qualifications. You can look at when they're available and how much they charge. In other words, you decide who, when, how, and even where. Because it's online, all you need is internet, a Skype connection, and you can have the class whenever you want. So it's very convenient. As I said, it's affordable because you can pay more or less depending on your budget. And if you sign up to iTalki through Aprender Inglés con Rosie Craig, that's inglespodcast.com/iTalki, iTalki will give you 100 credits to get started, which should be enough for you to do your first class. So you'll get your first introductory class free. See how it goes. We're sure you'll like it and carry on from there. Craig and I would like to say thank you to iTalki for sponsoring Aprender Inglés con Resi Craig.
We've received some feedback, an email from Edgar Ubaldo from Mexico, who, if you remember, sent us a question about the Mexican wall back in episode 149. So to hear our discussion on that, go to inglespodcast.com/149. So Edgar has written to us with a couple of comments and questions. Let me read his email. My dear friends, this is Edgar Ubaldo from Mexico again. According to Longman, the TOEFL preparation course, obviously he's studying TOEFL, it is possible to use inversion with negative expressions. Inversion, inverting the verb and the subject. And he gives the examples such as never, hardly ever, etc. So perhaps that would be, never have I heard such a wonderful podcast, or hardly ever had I seen such a beautiful girl. That idea of inversion. So he says, because of that, and following my previous message, I wrote, never shall we pay for that wall. Nevertheless, I won't use this expression in an English test or a normal conversation. Is this okay, or should I not use inversion in cases like this? Well, that sounded okay to me. He's using it for emphasis, isn't he, Reza? Instead of saying, I shall never pay, or we shall never pay, sorry, he's putting the never at the beginning of the phrase to emphasize the fact that he won't pay. Never, never shall we pay for that wall. Do you agree?
Yes, it emphasizes the word never. By putting it first, you emphasize it even more. You show complete determination. Or if you said, hardly ever do I meet my friends these days. I'm too busy. Hardly ever do I meet my friends. You're stressing the fact that it's hardly ever. Very, very, very rarely. And that's sad.
Yeah. Also, rarely would work. Rarely, rarely these days do I go out of an evening.
And to answer your question, Edgar, yes, you can use it. It is common. It's common, but only to emphasize the first word or phrase, like rarely, never. When you want to emphasize it, it's common to use it. But don't use it unless you really want to emphasize it. If not, just do it the normal way.
And as with those adverbs of frequency, as I'm sure you remember, put them before the main verb. So if there's an auxiliary verb, between the auxiliary verb and the main verb. I have never been to Paris, for example.
And just like in Spanish, special effects like this, if you overuse them, they lose their effect and sound silly. So just like the Spanish word for never, jamás or nunca jamás, it can go in different places. So you can say, no lo haré jamás. Or you can say, jamás lo haré, nunca, jamás. So by putting jamás or nunca or even nunca jamás, at the beginning of a sentence, you emphasize it more. Well, it's the same in English. But if you were to do that too often, you would sound silly. Like imagine my mother said to me, Reza, now finish your dinner. Don't leave any on the plate. And I said to her, never will I finish my dinner. She would think I'd gone a bit crazy. She would just say, well, okay, don't finish it if you don't want to. But to use an inversion and be so dramatic in that situation just sounds silly. It's unnecessarily emphatic. So only use it, Edgar, when you need to.
Yeah. And Edgar continues on the idea of word order in sentences and clauses, and he's reading at the moment A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. And he says, additionally, in a book I'm reading, A Tale of Two Cities, there are some questions that don't follow the right word order. And he gives some examples. There are two other points on which I'm anxious to be instructed. I may go on. Another example. You are sure that he is not under too great a strain? And his final example from the book, it would show itself in some renewal of this disorder. So as Edgar has cleverly noticed, these are not really question orders, they're statement orders. But the order of statements, not of questions. Because you would invert the order to make the question. In modern English, you would say, would it show itself? Not it would show itself. You would say, are you sure? Not you are sure. So I don't know if you agree, Reza, but I'm thinking this book was written over 100 years ago. It's English we don't use now. And with time, grammar and vocabulary change. And this is an example of English that was over 100 years ago, now changing into more modern English. Do you think so?
Yes, partly that, but I think there's more to it than that. That's totally true. But we still use this device of not using a word order to make a question. In modern English, it shows doubt. For example, I say to Craig, what do you want for lunch? And he says, I want one slice of bread. Now, Craig, he's not a greedy pig, but normally he has more than one slice of bread. So Craig says to me, I want one slice of bread. And I say, you want one slice of bread? That's your lunch? Which doesn't seem very much to me. So by not inverting the word order, mm-hmm. instead of saying, do you want one slice of bread? By saying, you want one slice of bread?
That's true. But you're
showing that I have doubt. I find it hard to believe.
But that's shown not in the word order, but in the intonation. If you change the intonation, it completely changes the meaning.
Right.
You want one slice of bread is an assertion. It's something, it's almost like an order. But because your intonation was so like a question, you want one slice of bread and it goes up at the end, that becomes a question.
Right.
Yep.
Exactly. So it is actually used in modern English as well, Edgar, but more to show doubt. Whereas, as Craig says, I think in this case, because it's Charles Dickens, it's old literature, it's just an old style of writing a question, which is a little bit old-fashioned these days.
And Edgar finishes his email. And finally, friends, especially Reza, I would like to know the grammar behind this expression, which was taken from the same book. I quote, he approached his second and last point. He felt it to be the most difficult of all. But, remembering his old Sunday morning conversation with Miss Pross, and remembering what he had seen in the last 9 days, he knew that he must face it. And that's from A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. Edgar's question, why is it past simple plus modal in present to talk about something that happened in the past? So it was, he knew that he must face it. He says, I constantly try to express the same and said, I knew I should have faced it, or something like that. Any comments?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I should have faced it. No. The normal, the typical, everyday modern English thing to say would be, he knew that he had to face it, because had to is the past of must.
Mm-hmm. For obligation.
Yeah. The past of must is had to. So you know that must is similar to have to in the present. And the past of must or have to is had to. However, Edgar, it is quite common to use must instead of had to, even though it's the past, like your example, he knew that he must face it, to make the story sound more lively and real. By using the present, he must, it's as if it were happening now in the present. So it's especially typical in storytelling or literature because it makes you feel when you're reading it that even though it happened in the past, like you're living the moment now by using the present, he must, it sounds more alive. That's the reason.
More immediate. And we spoke about this when we did the podcast on storytelling and how to make your stories more engaging and more interesting by using present tenses.
Yeah. So it's not wrong, but it's let's call it a literary or storytelling technique. But in more normal conversational English, you would say he knew that he had to face it would be more typical.
So we hope that's helped you, Edgar. We thank you for your very, very interesting questions. And we're very happy that you're reading Charles Dickens and especially that you're noticing these differences in the language and you're asking yourself, why is it like this? So great. Well done. If you have any future questions, don't hesitate to get in touch again. Next, we have some audio feedback from Evelyn Fernandez, who asks about advice for the TOEFL test in the speaking part. So let's listen to Evelyn.
Hi, Reza and Craig. I've been listening to your podcast for the last 3 months, and I want to thank you because your help is really useful. Yesterday, I took the TOEFL test and I didn't do it very well. I was very confident about it and I thought I would do it excellent, but then I got nervous and I couldn't do the speaking section very well. I'm afraid that I didn't reach the score that I need to apply for a scholarship, but I will keep trying. If you guys have some advice about this kind of test, please share with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your message, Evelyn. Thanks for taking the time to record that for us. I thought your speaking was very, very good. I was very impressed by your pronunciation, the way you expressed yourself. What did you think, Reza?
Yes, I think you should be able to get a good mark in a TOEFL exam. But you know what? I think the number one difficulty to get a good mark in the speaking is to overcome your nerves.
Yeah.
In a TOEFL exam. It's a very nerve-wracking experience. It makes you very nervous if you don't practice a lot beforehand. And even if you do practice, you're still nervous. But the more you practice before you go into that exam, the better, because then you'll get used to the situation and the format, because it's a tricky exam. It's a hard exam.
Mm-hmm. And I think the TOEFL exam, the TOEFL test is more common for people living in, it's a more of a US-based entrance exam and level test. Whereas over here in Europe, it's more common to take the IELTS test, especially for entrance into universities in the UK. But over in America, and especially for Latin American students, then you'll probably be taking the TOEFL test. So just a quick summary of it. It's a 20-minute test, a 20-minute speaking test. There are six questions. And the first two questions are about very familiar topics. And then the other four questions are based around short readings and lectures and conversations. So you read some text and then you have a very short time after you read each question to prepare your response. And you speak into a microphone, and then you're evaluated after you're marked on delivery, so how you deliver your spoken English, language use, how you're using grammar and vocabulary expressions and collocation, and something called topic development, which is how you develop the subject you're speaking about. So, of course, timing is very important, isn't it, Reza? You really have to be aware of timing.
Yeah, timing is of the essence.
We actually spoke about the TOEFL and the IELTS test on a previous episode, didn't we, Reza?
Yes, we spoke about TOEFL and IELTS exam in episode 68 of the podcast. So if you go to englishpodcast.com/68, you should get there a bit more information about the entire TOEFL exam as well as IELTS. But just focusing on the speaking, it's a tricky exam, as Craig said. And because you have to speak to a computer, it's obviously very, 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 very strictly timed. There's no person.
It suddenly just stops, like our voice messages when you send us voice messages on SpeakPipe.
When the time's up, it's up. So I would say to Evelyn and everybody thinking about doing the TOEFL test, you must practice a lot in front of a computer. Speak to the computer, even though your computer's turned off. To speak to it, to get used to the idea. That's what you're going to have to do in the exam. With a stopwatch, you could use your mobile phone if you don't have one. With a stopwatch, a chronometer, timing yourself, because it's really hard to fit everything in the time they give. Another thing is to take notes. They give you a little bit of time.
It's about 15 seconds, I think.
Something like that. It's not a lot, but believe me, it makes a difference. So for some of the questions, you first read. And then they give you a little while to prepare. And for other questions in the speaking exam, you first listen and then you speak. It's kind of a mixture. But don't waste that time. Take a few notes and use those notes. Don't attempt to write sentences, just a few words to remind you about what you're going to say, because otherwise you might get nervous and forget what you were going to say.
Like keywords and key expressions, bullet points to help as a guide while you're speaking.
Yep. And this sounds really silly, but breathe deeply. Out.
Relax.
Sounds obvious, but when you get nervous, you forget to do these things. You're so worried about getting it right that you just, like me now, you keep talking without pausing and you don't want to do it. And suddenly, and it all goes wrong.
Yeah.
If you just breathe in and out normally, that will help a lot.
Sometimes, though, we give presentations about podcasts, Reza and I get very nervous when I have to speak in front of people and give a presentation. By the way, if you'd like us to speak, you can send us an email and we'll give our address at the end. We'll be happy to come to your school and speak to you about podcasts. But I breathe a few deep breaths before we start at the beginning, just in and out. And it's surprising how that deep breathing relaxes you, brings you down and calm, ready to start the test and ready to start speaking.
And just before we started to record this podcast, we were talking about what other things we could think of to help you, Albira. And Craig came up with a really practical and important idea about speaking in noisy places, wasn't it, Craig?
Yeah, you have to speak. There are people speaking around you usually in a TOEFL test because you're being recorded just speaking into the microphone. So go to bars and restaurants and pubs and practice speaking where there's a lot of background noise. Go to a pub quiz, a trivia quiz in your area, or just go out with a friend and practice speaking English in a noisy environment, in a noisy place. And that will help you to block out the background noise when you're actually doing the test.
So, Elvira, we hope that is some
and
use
timing,
to you.
Timing as well, to watch the time. So,
Time.
Did we say that?
Yeah, we said it. But let's reinforce that. Keep timing yourself. Look at the format for the exam. You can get this information on internet or you can go to episode 68 of our podcast. Follow the timing strictly when you're practicing, because that's what's going to happen in your exam. And they won't give you a single millisecond more than the time you're allowed.
And there's one other little tip that I just thought of, Evelyn. When you're speaking into a microphone, there's no interaction, is there? You're speaking into something that isn't speaking back. And then you've got a little bit of nerves from the test. So what I did when I first started podcasting, this is before Reza joined me on the podcast, I put a photograph of a friend next to the microphone, and I imagined I was speaking to that person. So if you can focus on one good friend or one person in your family that is the person you're speaking to, I think it's easier to speak than just speaking into a microphone because it's a test. So just have one person fixed in your mind. That is the person you're speaking to, and that is the person you're explaining things to during the test. Keep trying, Evelyn. Don't give up. Go back and do it again. And please keep in touch with us and let us know how it's going.
Okay, well, now it's your turn to practice your English. Do you have a question for us or an idea for a future episode? If you do, why not send us a voice message and tell us what you think? You can send it to www.speakpipe.com/inglespodcast.
Or you could send us an email with a comment or question to me, Craig, at inglespodcast.com.
Or to me, Reza, at belfastreza@gmail.com.
And if you would like to support our Patreon program and contribute to the show and our show notes, go to patreon.com/inglespodcast. And Reza, let's thank our lovely sponsors. Who are they?
Many thanks to Carlos, Zara, Mamen, Juan, Sara, Corey Finneran, Jorge, Raul, Rafael, Manuel Tarazona, Mariel, Maite, Pedro, Ana, Maria, and our latest sponsor, Nicolai.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your support. And of course, thanks to Arminda from Madrid, who is continuing to transcribe four transcriptions for you. And you can find the transcriptions for episodes 131, 134, 135, 136, 138, 139, and 140. Everything Reza and I says has been painstakingly transcribed for your listening and reading pleasure by Arminda from Madrid. What's next week, Reza?
In next week's episode, farming and agriculture.
Ooh, are we going down on the farm next week? Going on our tractors. And speaking about farming and agriculture vocabulary, until then, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
Thanks for listening. The music in this podcast is by Pitts. The track is called See You Later.